Chapter 21.
Where is she? Where the bloody fuck is she? This is getting beyond a joke. I've spent 3 days searching. I've been to every vintage shop I can think of and hissed, Sadie, through the racks of clothes. I've knocked on the doors of all the flats in this building and called out, I'm looking for my friend Sadie, loud enough for her to hear. I've been to the Flashlight Dance Club and peered among the dancers on the dance floor, but there was no sign of her. Yesterday I went to Edna's house and made up a story about my cat being lost, which resulted in both of us going around the house calling, Sadie! Puss, puss, puss! But there was no answer. Edna was very sweet, and she's promised to get in touch if she sees a stray tabby around the place, but that doesn't exactly help me. Looking for lost ghosts is a total pain, it turns out. No one can see them. No one can hear them. You can't pin a photo to a tree with missing ghost. You can't ask anyone, have you seen my friend the ghost? Looks like a flapper. Shrieky voice? Ring any bells? Now I'm standing in the British Film Institute. There's an old black-and-white movie playing, and I'm at the back, scanning the dark rows of heads. But it's no good. How am I supposed to see anything in this pitch blackness? I start creeping down the aisle, crouching down, looking right and left along the dimly lit profiles. Sadie! I hiss as discreetly as I can. Shh! Says someone. Sadie! Are you there? I whisper as I reach the next row. Sadie! Shut up! Oh, God, this will never work. There's only one thing for it. Plucking up all my courage, I stand up straight, take a deep breath, and call out at the top of my voice. Sadie! It's Lara here! Shh! If you're here, please let me know. I know you're upset, and I'm sorry, and I want to be friends, and... Shut up! Who is that?
Be quiet.
There's a wave of head turning and angry exclamations along the rows, but no answering call from Sadie.
Excuse me.
An usher has come up. I'm going to have to ask you to leave. Okay, I'm sorry, I'll go. I follow the usher back up the aisle toward the exit, then suddenly turn around for one last shot. Sadie! Sadie! Please be quiet, exclaims the usher furiously. This is a cinema. I'm desperately peering into the blackness, but there's no sight of her pale, skinny arms, no beads clicking, no feathers bobbing among the heads. The usher escorts me right out of the BFI, issuing me with stern warnings and lectures all the way, then leaves me alone on the sidewalk, feeling like a dog who's been kicked out of a house. Deflated, I start trudging along, shrugging my jacket on. I'll have a coffee and regroup, although, to be honest, I'm nearly out of ideas. As I head toward the river, there's the London Eye, towering into the sky, still making its way around jauntily, like nothing ever happened. Glumly, I turn my head away. I don't want to see the London Eye. I don't want to be reminded of that day. Trust me to have a painful, embarrassing moment on the most prominent site in London. Why couldn't I have chosen a small, out-of-the-way spot which I could then avoid? I head into a cafe, order a double-strength cappuccino, and slump into a chair. It's starting to get me down, all this searching. The adrenaline that powered me to begin with is fading away. But what if I never find her? But I can't let myself think like that. I have to keep going. Partly because I refuse to admit defeat. Partly because the longer Sadie's gone, the more worried I am about her. And partly because, if I'm honest, I'm clinging on to this. While I'm searching for Sadie, it feels as if the rest of my life is on hold. I don't have to think about the where does my career go now thing, or the what do I tell my parents thing, or the how could I have been so stupid about Josh thing, or even the Ed thing, which still upsets me whenever I let myself think about it. So I just won't. I'll focus on Sadie, my holy grail. I know it's ridiculous, but I feel like if I can just track her down, everything else might fall into place. Briskly, I unfold my list of find Sadie ideas, but most of them are crossed out. The cinema was the most promising. The only other entries are Try Other Dancing Clubs and Nursing Home. I consider the nursing home for a moment as I sip my coffee. Sadie wouldn't go back there, surely. She hated it. She couldn't even face going in. Why would she be there now? But it's worth a try. I almost put on a disguise before I arrive at the Fairside home. I'm so nervous. I mean, here I am, the girl who accused the staff of murder, pitching up on the doorstep. Did they know it was me? I keep wondering in trepidation. Did the police tell them it was Lara Linton who besmirched your good name? Because, if so, I'm dead meat. They'll surround me in a nurse mob and kick me with their white clumpy shoes. The old people will bash me with their walkers, and I'll deserve it. But as Ginny opens the door, she shows no sign of knowing I'm the false accusation maker. Her face creases into a warm smile, and of course I feel guiltier than ever. Lara, what a surprise! Can I help you with that? I'm slightly laden down with cardboard cartons and a massive flower arrangement, which is starting to slip out of my arms. Oh, thanks, I say gratefully, handing her one. It's got boxes of chocolate in it for you all. Goodness! And these flowers are for the staff, too. I follow her into the beeswax-scented hall and put the arrangement on the table. I wanted to say thank you to everyone for looking after my great-aunt Sadie so well, and not murdering her. The thought never crossed my mind. How lovely! Everybody will be very touched. Well, I say awkwardly, on behalf of the family, we're all very grateful and feel bad that we didn't visit my great-aunt more often. Ever. As Ginny unpacks the chocolates, exclaiming in delight, I surreptitiously sidle toward the stairs and look up them. Sadie, I hiss under my breath. Are you here? I scan the upstairs landing, but there's no sign. And what's this? Ginny is looking at the other cardboard carton. More chocolates? No, actually that's some CDs and DVDs for the other residents. I open it and pull out the CDs. Charleston tunes. The best of Fred Astaire. 1920s to 1940s. The collection. I just thought sometimes they might like to listen to the tunes they danced to when they were young, I say tentatively. Especially the really old residents. It might cheer them up. Lara, how incredibly thoughtful. We'll put one on straight away. She heads into the day room, which is full of elderly people sitting in chairs and on sofas, with a daytime talk show blaring out of the television. I follow, looking all around the white heads for any sign of Sadie.
Sadie,
I hiss, looking around. Sadie, are you here? There's no reply. I should have known this was a ridiculous idea. I should leave.
There we are.
Ginny straightens up from the CD player. It should come on in a minute. She zaps the TV off, and we both stand motionless, waiting for the music. And then it starts. A scratchy 1920s recording of a jaunty, jazzy tune. It's a bit faint, and after a moment, Ginny increases the volume to full blast. On the other side of the room, an old man sitting under a tartan blanket with a tank of oxygen next to him turns his head. I can see the light of recognition coming on in faces around the room. Somebody starts humming along in a quavery voice. One woman even begins tapping her hand, her whole self lit up with pleasure. They love it, says Ginny to me. What a good idea. Shame we've never thought of it before. I feel a sudden lump in my throat as I watch. They're all Sadie inside, aren't they? They're all in their 20s inside. All that white hair and wrinkled skin is just cladding. The old man with the oxygen tank was probably once a dashing heartthrob. That woman with distant, roomy eyes was once a mischievous young girl who played pranks on her friends. They were all young, with love affairs and friends and parties and an endless life ahead of them. And as I'm standing there, the weirdest thing happens. It's as if I can see them, the way they were, I can see their young, vibrant selves rising up out of their bodies, shaking off the oldness, starting to dance with each other to the music. They're all dancing the Charleston, kicking up their heels skittishly, their hair dark and strong, their limbs lithe again, and they're laughing, clutching each other's hands, throwing back their heads, revelling in it. I blink. The vision has gone. I'm looking at a room full of motionless, old people. I glance sharply at Ginny, but she's just standing there, smiling pleasantly and humming along to the CD, out of tune. The music is still playing away, echoing through the rest of the home. Sadie can't be here. She would have heard the music and come to see what was going on. The trail's gone cold yet again. I know what I meant to ask you. Ginny suddenly turns to me. Did you ever find that necklace of Sadie's, the one you were looking for? The necklace. Somehow, with Sadie gone, that all seems a million miles away now. No, I never did. I try to smile. This girl in Paris was supposed to be sending it to me, but I'm still hoping. Oh, well, fingers crossed, says Ginny. Fingers crossed, I nod. Anyway, I'd better go. I just wanted to say hi. Well, it's lovely to see you. I'll show you out. As we make our way through the hall, my head is still full of the vision I saw of all the old people dancing, young and happy again. I can't shake it. Ginny, I say on impulse as she opens the big front door, you must have seen a lot of old people passing on. Yes, I have, she says matter-of-factly. That's the peril of the job. Do you believe in... I cough, feeling embarrassed. In the afterlife? Do you believe in spirits coming back and that kind of thing? My mobile phone rings shrilly in my pocket before Ginny can answer, and she nods at it. Please do get that. I haul it out and see Dad's number on the ID display. Oh, God, why is Dad calling? He'll have heard about me leaving my job somehow. He'll be all stressy and asking what my plans are, and I can't even dodge the call with Ginny watching. Hi, Dad, I say hurriedly. I'm just in the middle of something. Can I put you on hold a minute? I jab at the phone and look up at Ginny again. So, what you're asking is, do I believe in ghosts? She says with a smile. Yes, I suppose I am. Truthfully, no, I don't. I think it's all in the head, Lara. I think it's what people want to believe. But I can understand what a comfort it must be to those who have lost loved ones. Right. I nod, digesting this. Well, bye, and thanks. The door closes, and I'm halfway down the path before I remember Dad, still waiting patiently on the line. I grab my phone and press talk. Hey, Dad, sorry about that.
Not at all, darling. I'm sorry to disturb you at work.
Work? So he doesn't know. Oh, right, I say quickly, crossing my fingers. Work? Yes, absolutely. Work? Where else would I be? I give a shrill laugh. Although, as it happens, I'm not in the office right now.
Ah, well, this may be ideal timing, then.
Dad hesitates.
I know this may sound odd, but I've got something I need to talk to you about, and it's rather important. Could we meet?
Chapter 22.
This is weird. I'm really not sure what's going on. We've agreed to meet at Linton's in Oxford Street, because it's central and we both know it, and also because whenever we arrange to meet up, Dad suggests Linton's. He's unfailingly loyal to Uncle Bill. Plus, he has a Linton's Gold VIP card, which gets you free coffee and food anywhere, anytime. I don't. I only have friends and family. 50% off. Not that I'm complaining. As I arrive at the familiar chocolate brown and white frontage, I'm quite apprehensive. Maybe Dad's got some really bad news to break, like Mum's ill, or he's ill. And even if he hasn't, what am I going to say about my bust-up with Natalie? How will he react when he realizes his flake of a daughter has invested loads of money in a business only to walk out on it? Just the thought of seeing his face crumple in disappointment, yet again, makes me wince. He'll be devastated. I can't tell him. Not yet. Not until I have a plan of action. I push open the door and inhale the familiar scent of coffee, cinnamon, and baking croissant. The plushy brown velvet chairs and gleaming wooden tables are the same as in every other Lingtons around the world. Uncle Bill is beaming down from a massive poster behind the counter. Lington's mugs, coffee pots, and grinders are arranged on a display shelf, all in the trademark chocolate brown and white. No one else is allowed to use that shade of chocolate brown, apparently. It belongs to Uncle Bill.
Lara!
Dad waves from the head of the queue.
Just in time. What do you want?
Oh, he looks quite cheerful. Maybe he's not ill. Hi! I give him a hug. I'll have a caramel Lingtoncino and a tuna melt. You can't ask for a cappuccino in Lingtons. It has to be a Lingtoncino. Dad orders the coffees and food, then proffers his gold VIP card.
What's this?
Says the guy behind the till, looking dubious.
I've never seen one of these before. Try scanning it,
says Dad politely.
Wow.
The guy's eyes widen as something bleeps on the till screen. He looks up at Dad a bit awestruck.
That'll be... free. I always feel a bit guilty using that card,
confesses Dad, as we collect our coffees and make our way to a table.
I'm doing poor Bill out of his rightful income.
Poor Bill. I feel a tiny wrench in my heart. Dad is so good. He thinks about everyone except himself. I think he can probably afford it. I glance wryly at Uncle Bill's face printed on my coffee mug.
Probably.
Dad smiles and glances at my jeans.
You're dressed very casually, Lara. Is this the new dress-down approach at your office?
Shit. I never even thought about what I was wearing. Actually, I've been at a seminar, I hurriedly improvise. They requested casual clothes. It was role-play, that kind of thing.
Wonderful,
says Dad, so encouragingly that my cheeks flame with guilt. He unwraps a sugar and pours it into his coffee, then stirs it.
Lara, I want to ask you a question.
Absolutely. I nod earnestly.
How is your business going, really?
Oh, God. Of all the zillions of questions he could have asked. Well, you know, it's good. My voice has shot up two notches. All good. We've got some great clients and we've recently done some work with Macrosant. And Natalie's back now.
Back?
Echoes Dad with interest.
Has she been away?
The thing about lying to your parents is you have to keep track of which lies you've told. She popped away for a little bit. I force myself to smile. No big deal.
But you felt you made the right decision.
Dad looks as if this really matters to him.
You're enjoying it?
Yes, I say miserably. I'm enjoying it.
You feel the business has a good future?
Yes, really good. I stare at the table. The thing about lying to your parents is, sometimes you really wish you hadn't. Sometimes you just want to dissolve into tears and wail, Dad, it's all gone wrong. What shall I do? So, what did you want to talk to me about? I say to get off the subject.
No matter.
Dad gives me an affectionate look.
You've answered my question already. Your business is going well. It's fulfilling you. That's all I needed to hear.
What do you mean? I stare at him, confused. Dad shakes his head, smiling.
There was an opportunity I wanted to talk to you about, but I don't want to disrupt your new business. I don't want to throw a spanner in the works. You're doing what you love and doing it well. You don't need a job offer.
Job offer? My heart is suddenly beating fast, but I mustn't give away my excitement. Why don't you tell me about it anyway? I try to sound casual. Just in case.
Darling.
Dad laughs.
You don't have to be polite.
I'm not being polite, I say quickly. I want to know.
I wouldn't insult you. Darling, I'm so proud of what you've achieved,
says Dad lovingly.
This would mean you'd have to give it all up. It wouldn't be worth it.
Maybe it would. Just tell me. Shit, I sound too desperate. I quickly adjust my expression to one of mild interest. I mean, why not just fill me in? It can't do any harm.
Well, maybe you're right.
Dad takes a sip of coffee, then looks at me directly.
Bill called me yesterday. Quite a surprise.
Uncle Bill, I say, taken aback.
He said you'd been to see him at his house recently.
Oh, I clear my throat. Yes, I did pop round for a chat. I was going to tell you.
Not? Well, he was impressed. What did he describe you as now?
Dad gives that crooked little smile he gets when he's amused.
Oh, yes, tenacious. Anyway, the upshot is this.
He takes an envelope out of his pocket and slides it across the table. Disbelievingly, I open it. It's a letter on Linton's headed paper. It's offering me a full-time job in the Linton's Human Resources Department. It's offering me a salary of six figures. I feel a bit faint. I look up to see Dad's face glowing. Despite his cool demeanour, he's obviously really chuffed.
Bill read it out over the phone before he biked it over. Quite something, isn't it?
I don't understand. I rub my brow, feeling confused. Why did he send the letter to you? Why not straight to me?
Bill thought it would be a nice touch.
Oh, right.
Smile, darling.
Dad laughs.
Whether you take it up or not, it's a huge compliment.
Right, I say again. But I can't smile. Something's wrong.
It's a wonderful tribute to you,
Dad is saying.
I mean, Bill doesn't owe us anything. He's done this purely through appreciation of your talent and the goodness of his heart.
Okay, that's what's wrong. Dad's nailed it. I don't believe in Uncle Bill's appreciation of my talent, nor in the goodness of his heart. I drop my gaze down to the letter again, to the six-figure sum printed in black and white. Suspicions are creeping over me like spiders. He's trying to buy me off. Okay, maybe that's putting it too strongly, but he's trying to get me on side. I've got under Uncle Bill's skin. Ever since I mentioned Sadie's necklace, I saw it in his eyes instantly. A shock, a wariness, and now, out of the blue, a job offer.
But I don't want this to sway you,
Dad is saying.
Mum and I are both so proud of you, Lara, and if you want to carry on with your business, we'll be 100% behind you. The choice is absolutely up to you. No pressure either way.
He's saying all the right things, but I can see the hope flickering in Dad's eyes, even if he's trying to hide it. He'd love me to have a stable job at a massive multinational firm, and not just any massive multinational firm, the family massive multinational firm. And Uncle Bill knows that. Why else has he sent this letter via Dad? He's trying to manipulate both of us.
I think Uncle Bill feels rather bad that he turned you down flat at the funeral,
Dad continues.
He was very impressed at your persistence, and so am I. I had no idea you were planning to go and ask him again.
But I didn't even mention a job. I went to ask him about... I stop hopelessly. I can't mention the necklace. I can't mention Sadie. This is all impossible.
To be honest,
Dad lowers his voice, leaning across the little table.
I think Bill's been having a few problems with Diamante. He regrets having brought her up so lavishly. We had quite a heart-to-heart. And do you know what he said?
Dad's face suffuses with pleasure.
He said he sees you as the kind of self-starting young person who should be a role model for Diamante.
He doesn't really think that, I want to cry out. You don't know what's going on. He just wants me to stop chasing the necklace. I bury my head in my hands despairingly. It's such a preposterous story. It all sounds so unlikely. And now the necklace is gone, and Sadie's gone, and I don't know what to think or do.
Laura, exclaims Dad, darling, are you all right?
I'm fine. I raise my head. Sorry, it's all just a bit overwhelming.
This is my fault, says Dad, his smile fading. I've thrown you. I should never have mentioned it. Your business is doing so well.
Oh, God, I can't let this charade go on any longer. Dad, I cut him off. The business isn't going well.
I'm sorry.
It's not doing at all well. I lied. I didn't want to tell you. I'm crushing a sugar wrapper between my fingers, unable to meet his eye. But the truth is, it's a disaster. Natalie left me in the lurch, and we had a big row, and I walked out on her. And I've split up with Josh again. For good. I swallow, forcing myself to say it. I finally realized how wrong I got everything with him. He didn't love me. I just really, really wanted him to.
I see.
Dad sounds a bit shocked.
Goodness.
There's silence as he takes this all in.
Well, perhaps this offer has come at just the right time, he says at last.
Maybe, I mumble, still staring at the table.
What's wrong?
Asks Dad gently.
Darling, why are you resisting this? You wanted to work for Uncle Bill.
I know, but it's complicated.
Laura, can I give you a piece of advice?
Dad waits until I look up.
Don't be so hard on yourself. Relax. Maybe it's not as complicated as you think.
I look at Dad, at his straight face, his honest eyes. If I told him the truth, he wouldn't believe any of it. He'd think I'm a paranoid delusional, or taking drugs, or both. Did Uncle Bill mention a necklace at all? I can't help saying.
A necklace?
Dad looks puzzled.
No. What necklace?
It's nothing. I sigh. I take a sip of Lintoncino and look up to see that Dad is watching me. He smiles, but I can tell he's troubled.
Darling, you have a wonderful opportunity here.
He gestures at the letter.
A chance for you to get your life back on track. Maybe you should just take it. Don't overthink it. Don't look for problems that don't exist. Just take your chance.
He doesn't understand. How could he? Sadie isn't a problem that doesn't exist. She does exist. She's real. She's a person. And she's my friend. And she needs me. Then where is she? Says a sharp voice in my head, like a knife thumping into a block. If she exists, where is she? I start in shock. Where did that voice come from? I can't be doubting. I can't be thinking. I feel a sudden feathery panic. Of course Sadie's real. Of course she is. Don't be ridiculous. Stop thinking like this. But now Ginny's voice is running through my head again. I think it's all in the head, Lara. It's what people want to believe. No. No way. I mean, no. Feeling giddy, I take a gulp of Lintoncino and look around the coffee shop, trying to anchor myself to reality. Lington's is real. Dad is real. The job offer is real. And Sadie is real. I know she is. I mean, I saw her. I heard her. We talked together. We danced together, for God's sake. And anyway, how could I possibly have invented her? How would I have known anything about her? How would I have known about the necklace? I never even met her. Dad? I look at him abruptly. We never visited Great Aunt Sadie, did we? Except that time when I was a baby.
Actually, that's not quite true.
Dad shoots me a cautious look.
Mum and I were talking about it after the funeral. We remembered that we once took you to see her when you were six.
Six? I swallow. Was she wearing a necklace?
She might have been.
Dad shrugs. I met Great Aunt Sadie at the age of six. I could have seen the necklace. I could have remembered, without realizing that I remembered. My thoughts are in freefall. I'm hollow and chilly inside. I feel as though everything's turning on its head. For the first time, I'm seeing a new possible reality. I could have made this whole story up in my head. It's what I wanted. I felt so guilty we never knew her that I invented her in my subconscious. I mean, when I first saw her, that's what I thought she was. A hallucination.
Lara?
Dad peers at me.
Are you okay, darling?
I try to smile back at him, but I'm too preoccupied. There are two voices arguing in my head, right across each other. The first is crying out, Sadie's real, you know she is. She's out there. She's your friend, and she's hurt, and you have to find her. The second is calmly intoning, She doesn't exist. She never did. You've wasted enough time. Get your life back. I'm breathing hard, trying to let my thoughts balance out, let my instincts settle. But I don't know what to think. I don't trust myself anymore. Maybe I really am crazy. Dad, do you think I'm mad? I blurt out in desperation. Seriously? Should I see someone? Dad bursts into laughter.
No, darling, of course not.
He puts his coffee cup down and leans forward.
I think your emotions run high, and sometimes your imagination, too. You get that from your mother, and sometimes you let them get the better of you. But you're not mad. No madder than Mum, anyway.
Right, I swallow. Right. That's not much consolation, to be honest. With fumbling fingers, I pick up Uncle Bill's letter and read it through again. If I look at it in a completely different way, there's nothing sinister. There's nothing wrong. He's just a rich guy trying to help out his niece. I could take the job. I'd be Lara Linton of Linton's Coffee. I'd have a great future in front of me. Salary, car, prospects. Everyone would be happy. Everything would be easy. My memories of Sadie would melt away. My life would feel normal. It would be so, so easy.
You haven't been home for a while,
Dad says kindly.
Why not come and spend the weekend? Mum would love to see you.
Yes, I say after a pause. I'd like that. I haven't been back for ages.
It'll restore your spirits.
Dad gives me his endearing little crooked smile.
If your life's at a juncture and you need to think about things, there's nowhere better than home, however old you are.
There's no place like home. I raise half a smile.
Dorothy had a point. Now eat up.
He gestures at my tuna melt, but I'm only half listening. Home. The word has riveted me. I never thought of that. She could have gone home. Home to where her old house used to be. After all, it's the place of her earliest memories. It's where she had her big love affair. She refused ever to go back during her lifetime. But what if she's softened? What if she's right there, right now? I'm stirring my Linton-chino around and around obsessively. I know the sane, sensible move would be to blank out all thoughts about her, accept Uncle Bill's job, and buy a bottle of champagne to celebrate with Mum and Dad. I know this, but I just can't. Deep down, I can't believe she's not real. I've come so far. I've tried so hard to find her. I have to give it one last go. And if she's not there, I'll take the job and give up. For good.
So?
Dad wipes his mouth with a chocolate-brown napkin.
You look happier, darling.
He jerks his head toward the letter.
Have you decided which way you want to go?
Yes. I nod firmly. I need to go to St. Pancras Station.
Chapter 23.
Okay. This is the very last place I'm looking. This is her last chance, and I hope she appreciates the effort I've made. It took me an hour from St. Pancras to St. Albans, and another 20 minutes in a taxi to Archbury. And now, here I am, standing in a little village square, with a pub and a bus stop, and a weird modern-looking church. I suppose it would be quite picturesque if lorries didn't keep rumbling by at a million miles an hour, and three teenage boys weren't having a brawl under the bus shelter. I thought it was supposed to be quiet in the country. I edge away before one of the boys pulls out a gun or something, and head over to the green. There's a board with a map of the village, and I quickly locate Archbury Close. That's what they turned Archbury House into after it burned down. If Sadie really has gone home, that's where she'll be. After a few minutes' walk, I can see the gates ahead, wrought iron with Archbury Close written in swirly iron writing. There are six little red brick houses, each with a tiny drive and garage. It's hard to imagine that once upon a time there was just one big, beautiful house sitting in its own gardens. Feeling conspicuous, I enter through a small side gate and start to wander around, peering in through the windows, crunching on the little patches of gravel, and murmuring, "Sadie?" I should have asked Sadie more about her home life. Maybe she had a favourite tree or something, or some favourite corner of the garden, which is now someone's utility room. There doesn't seem to be anyone around, so, after a bit, I raise my voice a little. "Sadie? Are you here? Sadie!"
"Excuse me?"
I jump in shock as someone pokes me in the back. I turn to see a grey-haired woman in a flowered shirt, tan slacks, and rubbery-looking shoes peering at me suspiciously.
"I'm Sadie. What do you want?"
"Are you here about the drainage?" she adds. No, I find my voice. "I was after a different Sadie."
"Which Sadie?"
Her eyes narrow.
"I'm the only Sadie in this close. Sadie Williams, number 4.
"Right. The Sadie I want is actually a dog," I improvise. "She ran away and I was looking for her, but I expect she's run off somewhere else. Sorry to bother you." I start to walk off, but Sadie Williams grabs my shoulder with surprisingly strong fingers.
"You let a dog loose in the close? What did you want to do that for? We have a dog-free policy here, you know."
"Well, sorry, I didn't know. Anyway, I'm sure she's run off somewhere else." I try to wriggle free.
"She's probably prowling around in the bushes, waiting to strike."
Sadie Williams is glowering furiously at me.
"Dogs are dangerous beasts, you know. We've got kiddies living here. You people are irresponsible."
"I'm not irresponsible," I retort indignantly before I can stop myself. "She's a perfectly friendly dog. I wouldn't let a dangerous dog loose."
"All dogs are savage."
"No, they're not." "Lara, stop it. You're talking about an imaginary dog." "And anyway," I finally wrench myself free from the woman's grasp. "I'm sure she's not here, because she would have come when I called. She's very obedient. In fact, she's a prize winner at Crufts," I add for good measure. "So I'd better go and find her." Before Sadie Williams can grab me again, I start walking swiftly toward the gates. There's no way Sadie's here. She would have come out to watch the entertainment.
"What breed is she, then?"
calls Sadie Williams tetchily.
"What are we looking for?"
Oh, God, I just can't help myself. "Pitbull," I call back over my shoulder. "But like I say, she's very friendly." Without looking back, I hurry out of the gates, back along the road and toward the village square. So much for that bright idea. What a waste of time. I head to the bench on the green and sink down and take out a Twix, my gaze fixed ahead. Coming here was stupid. I'll eat this, then call a taxi and head back to London. I'm not even going to think about Sadie any more, let alone look for her. I've used up enough of my life already. I mean, why should I think about her? I bet she isn't thinking about me. I finish my Twix and tell myself to dial the taxi number. It's time to go. It's time to put all this out of my mind and start on a new, sane, ghost-free life. Except, oh, God, I keep having flashes back to Sadie's stricken face on Waterloo Bridge. I keep hearing her voice. "You don't care about me. No one cares." If I give up after only 3 days, Am I proving her right? I feel a sudden surge of frustration. At her, at myself, at the whole situation. Crossly, I scrunch up my Twix wrapper and chuck it into a bin. I mean, what am I supposed to do? I've looked and looked and looked. If she would just come when I called her. If she would just listen and not be so stubborn. Hang on. A new thought strikes me, out of the blue. I'm psychic, aren't I? Maybe I should use my psychic powers. I should summon her from the underworld, or Harrods, or wherever she is. Okay, this is my last try. I really, really mean it. I stand up and approach the little pond on the green. I'm sure ponds are spiritual places, more spiritual than benches anyway. There's a mossy stone fountain in the middle, and I can just picture Sadie dancing in it, splashing and shrieking, all those years and years ago, with some policeman trying to drag her out. Spirits! I extend my arms cautiously. There's a rippling in the water, but that could just be the wind. I have no idea how to do this. I'll make it up as I go along. It is I, Lara, I intone in a low, sepulchral voice. Friend to the spirits. Or at least one spirit, I amend quickly. I don't want Henry VIII appearing. I seek Sadie Lancaster, I say momentously. There's silence, except for a duck quacking on the pond. Maybe seek isn't powerful enough. I hereby summon Sadie Lancaster, I intone more commandingly. From the depths of the spirit world I call her. I, Lara Lington, the psychic one. Hear my voice. Hear my summons. Spirits, I entreat thee. I start to wave my arms around impressively. If thou knowest Sadie, send her to me. Send her to me now. Nothing. Not a voice. Not a glimpse. Not a shadow. Fine, I say, dropping my arms down. Don't be summoned. I aim my words into the air in case she's listening. I don't care. I've got better things to do all day than stand here talking to the spirit world. So there. I stump back to the bench, pick up my bag, and grab my mobile phone. I dial the taxi firm that brought me here and ask for a taxi straight away. Enough is enough. I'm out of here. The taxi guy tells me the cab driver will meet me in front of the church in 10 minutes, so I head over to it, wondering if they might have a coffee machine in the lobby or anything. The whole place is locked up, though. I head back out and am just reaching for my phone again to check my texts when something catches my eye. It's a sign on a gate. The Old Vicarage. The Old Vicarage. I suppose that would have been where the vicar lived in the old days. Which means it would have been where Stephen Nettleton lived. He was the son of the vicar, wasn't he? Curiously, I peer over the wooden gate. It's a big old grey house with a gravel drive and some cars parked at the side. There are some people going in the front door, a group of about 6. The family living here must be at home. The garden's overgrown, with rhododendrons and trees, and a path leading round the side of the house. I can just glimpse an old shed in the distance, and wonder if that's where Stephen did his painting. I can just imagine Sadie creeping along that path, her shoes in one hand, her eyes shining in the moonlight. It's quite an atmospheric place, with its old stone wall and long grass and shady patches in the garden. Nothing modern seems to have been introduced. It's still got the feel of history to it. I wonder. No. Stop it, I'm giving up. I'm not looking any more. But maybe. No, she wouldn't be here. No way. She's got too much dignity. She said it herself. She'd never be a trailer. Never in a million years would she hang around an old boyfriend's house, especially the old boyfriend who broke her heart and never even wrote to her. It's a stupid idea. Already my hand is unlatching the gate. This is the very, very, very last place I'm looking. I crunch over the gravel, trying to think of an excuse to be here. Not a lost dog. Maybe I'm studying old vicarages. Maybe I'm an architecture student. Yes, I'm doing a thesis on religious buildings and the families who live in them, at Birkbeck. No, Harvard. I approach the entrance and am raising my hand to ring the old bell when I notice the front door is unlatched. Maybe I can sidle in without anyone noticing. I cautiously push the door open and find myself in a hall with panelled walls and old parquet. To my surprise, a woman with a mousy bob and a Fair Isle jumper is standing behind a table covered with books and leaflets. Hello. She smiles as though she's not at all surprised to see me. Are you here for the tour? The tour? Even better. I can wander around and I don't even have to invent a story. I had no idea vicarages were charging for tours these days, but I suppose it makes sense. Yes, please. How much? That'll be £5. 5 whole pounds? Just to see a vicarage? Bloody hell. Here's a guide. She hands me a leaflet, but I don't look at it. I'm not exactly interested in the house. I walk swiftly away from the woman, into a sitting room filled with old-fashioned sofas and rugs, and look all around.
Sadie, I hiss. Sadie, are you here?
This would have been where Mallory spent his evenings. The woman's voice makes me jump. I didn't realize she'd followed me. Oh, right. I have no idea what she's talking about. Lovely. I'll just go through here. I head into an adjacent dining room, which looks like a stage set for a period drama. Sadie? This was the family dining room, of course. For God's sake, people should be able to take tours of vicarages without being followed. I head over to the window and look out at the garden, where the family I saw before is wandering around. There's not a whisper of Sadie. This was a stupid idea. She's not here. Why would she hang around the house of the guy who broke her heart anyway? I turn around to leave and almost bump into the woman, standing behind me. I take it you're an admirer of his work? She smiles. Work? Whose work? Yes, I say hastily. Of course, a great admirer. Very great. For the first time, I glance down at the leaflet in my hand. The title reads, Welcome to the House of Cecil Mallory, and underneath is a landscape painting of some cliffs. Cecil Mallory. He's a famous artist, isn't he? I mean, not like Picasso, but I've definitely heard of him. For the first time, I feel a spark of interest. So, is this where Cecil Mallory once lived or something? I ask. Of course. She looks taken aback by the question. That's the reason for the house being restored as a museum. He lived here till 1927. Until 1927? Now I'm genuinely interested. If he was living here in 1927, Sadie would have known him, surely. They would have hung out together. Was he a friend of the vicar's son? A guy called Stephen Nettleton? Dear? The woman eyes me, apparently perplexed at the question. Surely you know that Stephen Nettleton was Cecil Mallory? He never used his family name for work. Stephen was Cecil Mallory? Stephen is Cecil Mallory? I'm too gobsmacked to speak. He later changed his name by deed poll, she continues, as a protest against his parents, it's thought, after his move to France. I'm only half listening. My mind is in turmoil. Stephen became a famous painter. This makes no sense. Sadie never told me he was a famous painter. She would have boasted unbearably about it. Didn't she know? And never reconciled before his tragically young death. The woman ends on a solemn note, then smiles. Perhaps you would like to see the bedrooms. No, I mean, sorry. I rub my forehead. I'm a bit confused. Cecil Mallory was a friend of my great-aunt, you see. She lived in this village. She knew him. But I don't think she ever realized he became famous. Ah. The woman nods knowledgeably. Well, of course he wasn't during his lifetime. It wasn't until long after his death that interest began in his paintings, first in France and then in his homeland. Since he died so young, there is, of course, a limited body of work, which is why his paintings became so prized and valuable. In the 1980s, they shot up in value. That's when his name really became known widely. The 1980s. Sadie had her stroke in 1981. She went into care. No one told her anything. She had no idea what was going on in the outside world. I look up from my reverie to see the woman giving me another odd look. I bet she's wishing she could give me my 5 quid back and get rid of me. Oh, sorry. I'm just thinking. Did he work in a shed in the garden? Yes. The woman's face lights up. If you're interested, we do sell a number of books on Mallory. She hurries out and returns holding a slim hardback. Details about his early life are a little sketchy, as many village records were lost during the war, and by the time the research was being done, many of his contemporaries had passed away. However, there are some lovely accounts of his time in France, when his landscape drawing really took off. She hands me the book, which has a painting of the sea on the front. Thanks. I take it from her and start flipping through. Almost at once, I come across a black-and-white photograph of a man painting on a cliff, captioned, "A rare image of Cecil Mallory at work." I can instantly see why he and Sadie would have been lovers. He's tall and dark and powerful-looking, with dark eyes and an ancient, tattered shirt. Bastard. He probably thought he was a genius. He probably thought he was too good for a normal relationship. Even though he's long dead, I'm fighting an urge to yell at him. How could he treat Sadie so badly? How could he go off to France and forget about her? He was a towering talent. The woman is following my gaze. His early death was one of the tragedies of the 20th century. Yeah, well, maybe he deserved it. I give her a baleful look. Maybe he should have been nicer to his girlfriend. Did you think of that? The woman looks totally confused. She opens her mouth and closes it again. I flip on. Past pictures of the sea and more cliffs and a line drawing of a hen. And then I suddenly freeze. An eye is looking out of the book at me. It's a blown-up detail from a painting. Just one eye, with long, long lashes and a teasing glint. I know that eye. Excuse me? I can barely get the words out. What's this? I'm jabbing at the book. Who's this? Where does this come from? Dear, I can see the woman trying to keep her patience. You must know that, surely. That's a detail from one of his most famous paintings. We have a version in the library if you'd like to have a look. Yes, I'm already moving. I would, please, show me. She leads me down a creaking corridor, through to a dim, carpeted room. There are bookshelves on every wall, old leather chairs, and a large painting hanging over the fireplace. There we are, she says fondly, our pride and joy. I can't reply. My throat's too tight. I stand motionless, clutching the book, just staring. There she is, gazing out of the ornate gilt frame, looking as though she owns the world, is Sadie. I've never seen her as radiant as she looks in this picture. I've never seen her so relaxed, so happy, so beautiful. Her eyes are massive, dark, luminous with love. She's reclining on a chaise, naked except for a gauze fabric draped over her shoulder and hips, which only partially obscures the view. Her shingled hair exposes the length of her elegant neck. She's wearing glittering earrings, and around her neck, falling down between her pale, gauzy breasts, twined around her fingers, tumbling in a shimmering pool of beads, is the dragonfly necklace. I can suddenly hear her voice again in my ears. I was happy when I wore it. I felt beautiful, like a goddess. It all makes sense. This is why she wanted the necklace. This is what it means to her. At that time in her life, she was happy. Never mind what happened before or after. Never mind that her heart got broken. At that precise moment, everything was perfect. It's amazing. I wipe a tear from my eye. Isn't she wonderful? The woman gives me a pleased look. Obviously, I'm finally behaving as proper art lovers are supposed to. The detail and brushwork are just exquisite. Every bead in the necklace is a tiny masterpiece. It's painted with such love. She regards the portrait affectionately. And all the more special, of course, because it's the only one. What do you mean? I say, confused. Cecil Mallory painted lots of pictures, didn't he? Indeed, but he never painted any other portraits. He refused to, his whole life. He was asked plenty of times in France as his reputation grew locally, but he would always reply, "J'ai peint celui que j'ai voulu peindre." The woman leaves a poetic pause. I have painted the one I wanted to paint. I stare at her, dumbfounded, my head sparking as I take this all in. He only ever painted Sadie. His whole life. He'd painted the one he wanted to paint. And in this bead, the woman moves toward the painting with a knowing smile. Right in this bead here, there's a little surprise. A little secret, if you like. She beckons me forward. Can you see it? I try to focus obediently on the bead. It just looks like a bead. It's almost impossible, except under a magnifying glass. Here. She produces a piece of matte paper. Printed on it is the bead from the painting, enlarged massively. As I peer at it, to my astonishment, I find I'm looking at a face. A man's face. Is that? I look up. Mallory. She nods in delight. His own reflection in the necklace. He put himself into the painting. The most miniature hidden portrait. It was discovered only 10 years ago, like a little secret message. May I see? With shaking hands, I take the paper from her and stare at him. There he is, in the painting, in the necklace, part of her. He never painted another portrait. He'd painted the one he wanted to paint. He did love Sadie. He did. I know it. I look up at the painting, tears blurring my eyes again. The woman's right. He painted her with love. You can see it in every brushstroke. It's amazing. I swallow. Are there, any more books about him? I'm desperate to get this woman out of the room. I wait until her footsteps have disappeared down the passage, then tilt my head up. Sadie! I call desperately. Sadie, can you hear me? I found the painting. It's beautiful. You're beautiful. You're in a museum. And you know what? Stephen didn't paint anyone but you. Never, his whole life. You were the only one. He put himself in your necklace. He loved you. Sadie, I know he loved you. I so wish you could see this. I break off breathlessly. But the room is silent and dead. She's not hearing me, wherever she is. As I hear footsteps, I quickly turn and plaster on a smile. The woman hands me a pile of books. This is all our available stock. Are you an art history student, or simply interested in Mallory? I'm just interested in this one painting, I say frankly. And I was wondering, do you, or the experts, have any idea who this is? What's the painting called? It's called Girl with a Necklace. And, of course, many people are interested in the identity of the sitter. The woman launches into what's clearly a well-rehearsed speech. Some research has been done, but unfortunately to date no one has been able to identify her beyond what is believed to be her first name. She pauses, then adds fondly, Mabel. Mabel? I stare at her in horror. She wasn't called Mabel. Dear. The woman gives me a reproving smile. I know to modern ears it may seem a little quaint, but believe me, Mabel was a common name of the time. And on the back of the painting there's an inscription. Mallory himself wrote, My Mabel. For God's sake. It was a nickname. It was their private joke. Her name was Sadie, okay? Sadie Lancaster. I'll write it down. And I know it was her because... I hesitate momentously. This is my great-aunt. I'm expecting a gasp or something, but the woman just gives me a dubious look. Goodness dear, that's quite a claim. What makes you think she's your great-aunt? I don't think she is. I know she is. She lived here in Archbury. She knew Steve... I mean Cecil Mallory. They were lovers. It's definitely her. Do you have any evidence? Do you have a photograph of her in her youth? Any archives? Well, no, I say, a little frustrated. But I know it's her, beyond a doubt. And I'll prove it somehow. And you should put up a sign saying her name and stop calling her Mabel. I pause mid-track, as something new and startling occurs to me. Hang on a minute. This is Sadie's painting. He gave it to her. She lost it for years, but it's still hers. Or, I suppose, Dad's and Uncle Bill's now. How did you get it? What's it doing here? I'm sorry. The woman sounds bewildered, and I give an impatient sigh. This painting belonged to my great-aunt, but it was lost years and years ago. The family house burned down, and she thought the painting was destroyed. So how did it end up hanging on this wall? I can't help sounding accusing, and she recoils. I'm afraid I have no idea. I've worked here for 10 years, and it's certainly been here all that time. Right, I assume a businesslike air. Well, can I please talk to the director of this museum, or whoever's in charge of this painting, at once? The woman gives me a wary, puzzled look. Dear... You do realize this is only a reproduction, don't you? What? I feel wrong-footed. What do you mean? The original is 4 times the size, and, dare I say it, even more splendid. But... I look at the painting in confusion. It looks pretty real to me. So where's the original? Locked up in a safe or something? No, dear, she says patiently. It's hanging in the London Portrait Gallery.
Chapter 24.
It's massive. It's radiant. It's 1,000,000 times better than the one in the house. I've been sitting in front of Sadie's portrait in the London Portrait Gallery for about 2 hours. I can't drag myself away. She's gazing out at the gallery, her brow clear, her eyes of velvety dark green, like the most beautiful goddess you've ever seen. Cecil Mallory's use of light on her skin is unmatched in its artistry. I know, because I heard an art teacher telling her class 30 minutes ago. Then they all went up to see if they could spot the little miniature portrait in the necklace. I must have seen 100 people coming and looking at her, sighing with pleasure, smiling at one another, or just sitting down and gazing. Isn't she lovely? A dark-haired woman in a mac smiles at me and sits down beside me on the bench. This is my favourite portrait in the whole gallery. Me too, I nod. I wonder what she's thinking, the woman muses. I think she's in love. I look yet again at Sadie's glowing eyes, the flush in her cheek. And I think she's really, really happy.
You're probably right.
For a moment we're both quiet, just drinking her in.
She does you good, doesn't she? Says the woman.
I often come and look at her in my lunch times, just to cheer myself up. I've got a poster of her at home, too. My daughter bought it for me. But you can't beat the real thing, can you? There's a sudden lump in my throat, but I manage to smile back. No, you can't beat the real thing. As I'm speaking, a Japanese family approaches the painting. I can see the mother pointing out the necklace to her daughter. They both sigh happily, then adopt identical poses, arms folded, heads tilted, and just gaze at her. Sadie's adored by all these people. Tens, hundreds, thousands. And she has no idea. I've called for her until I'm hoarse, over and over, out the window, up and down the street. But she doesn't hear, or she doesn't want to hear. Abruptly, I stand up and consult my watch. I have to go anyway. It's 5 o'clock. Time for my appointment with Malcolm Gledhill, the collections manager. I make my way back to the foyer, give my name to the receptionist, and wait among a swarming crowd of French schoolchildren until a voice from behind says,
"Miss Linton."
I turn to see a man in a purple shirt, with a chestnut beard and tufts of hair growing out of his ears, beaming at me with twinkly eyes. He looks like Father Christmas before he grew old, and I can't help warming to him instantly. "Hi. Yes, I'm Laura Linton."
"Malcolm Gledhill, come this way."
He leads me through a hidden door behind the reception desk, up some stairs, and into a corner office overlooking the Thames. Postcards and reproductions of paintings are everywhere, stuck up on the walls and propped against books and adorning his massive computer.
"So?"
He hands me a cup of tea and sits down.
"You're here to see me about Girl with a Necklace."
He eyes me warily.
"I wasn't sure from your message quite what the issue was, but it's clearly pressing."
"Okay, perhaps my message was a bit extreme. I didn't want to have to tell the whole story to some nameless receptionist, so I simply said it was to do with Girl with a Necklace and a matter of life and death, state urgency and national security. Well, in the art world it probably is all those things." "It is quite pressing," I nod, "and the first thing I want to say is, she wasn't just a girl, she was my great-aunt. Look." I reach into my bag and produce my photograph of Sadie at the nursing home, wearing the necklace. "Look at the necklace," I add as I hand it over. I knew I liked this Malcolm Gledhill guy. He reacts in a totally satisfactory manner. His eyes bulge. His cheeks turn pink with excitement. He looks up sharply at me, then back at the photo. He peers at the necklace around Sadie's neck. Then he gives a harrumphing cough, as though he's concerned he's given too much away.
"Are you saying," he says at last, "that this lady here is the Mabel in the painting?"
I really have to knock this Mabel thing on the head. She wasn't called Mabel. She hated the name Mabel. She was called Sadie. Sadie Lancaster. She lived in Archbury and she was Stephen Nettleton's lover. She was the reason he was sent to France. There's silence, apart from Malcolm Gledhill breathing out, his cheeks two deflating balloons of air.
"Do you have any evidence that this is the case?"
he says at last.
"Any documents? Any old photographs?"
"She's wearing the necklace, isn't she?" I feel a flicker of frustration. "She kept it all her life. How much more evidence do you need?"
"Does the necklace still exist?"
His eyes bulge again.
"Do you have it? Is she still alive?"
As this new thought occurs to him, his eyes nearly pop out of his head.
"Because that would really be..."
"She's just died, I'm afraid." I cut him off before he can get too excited. "And I don't have the necklace, but I'm trying to track it down."
"Well..."
Malcolm Gledhill takes out a paisley handkerchief and wipes his perspiring brow.
"Clearly, in a case like this, much careful inquiry and research is required before we can come to any definitive conclusion."
"It's her," I say firmly.
"So I'll refer you, if I may, to our research team. They will look at your claim very carefully, study all the evidence available."
He needs to play the official game properly. I can understand that. I'd love to talk to them, I say politely, and I know they'll agree with me. It's her. I suddenly spot a postcard of girl with a necklace stuck on his computer with blue tack. I take it down and lay it beside the photo of Sadie from the nursing home. For a moment, we both look silently at the two images. Two radiant, proud eyes in one picture, two hooded, ancient eyes in the other, and the necklace glimmering, a constant talisman, linking the two.
"When did your great-aunt die?"
says Malcolm Gledhill at last, his voice soft. "A few weeks ago. But she lived in a nursing home since the 1980s, and she didn't know much about the outside world. She never knew Stephen Nettleton became famous. She never knew that she was famous. She thought she was a nobody. And that's why I want the world to know her name." Malcolm Gledhill nods.
"Well, if the research team comes to the conclusion that she was the sitter in the portrait, then believe me, the world will know her name. Our marketing team did some research recently, and it turns out Girl with the Necklace is the most popular portrait in the gallery. They want to expand her profile. We consider her an exceedingly valuable asset."
"Really?" I flush with pride. "She'd have loved to know that."
"May I call in a colleague to see this photograph?"
His eyes brighten.
"He has a special interest in Mallory, and I know he will be extremely interested in your claim."
"Wait." I hold up a hand. "Before you call in anyone else, there's another issue I need to talk to you about, in private. I want to know how you got the painting in the first place. It belonged to Sadie. It was hers. How did you get it?" Malcolm Gledhill stiffens very slightly.
"I thought this matter might arise at some stage," he says. "Following your phone call, I went and retrieved the file, and I've looked up the details of the acquisition."
He opens a file, which has been sitting on the desk all this while, and unfolds an old piece of paper.
"The painting was sold to us in the 1980s.
"Sold? How could it have been sold? But it was lost after a fire. No one knew where it was. Who on earth sold it to you?"
"I am afraid..."
Malcolm Gledhill pauses.
"I'm afraid the vendor asked at the time that all details of the acquisition should be kept confidential."
"Confidential?" I stare at him in outrage. "But the painting was Sadie's. Stephen gave it to her. Whoever got hold of it didn't have the right to sell it. You should check these things."
"We do check these things,"
says Malcolm Gledhill, a little defensively.
"All the provenance was deemed to be correct at the time. The gallery went to all reasonable lengths to determine that the painting was the vendor's to sell. Indeed, a letter was signed in which the vendor made all the correct assurances. I have it here."
His eyes keep dropping down to the paper in his hand. He must be looking at the name of whoever sold it. This is totally maddening. "Well, whatever that person said to you, they were lying." I glare at him. "And you know what? I'm a taxpayer, and I fund you lot. In fact, in a way, I own you lot, and I hereby demand to know who sold it to you, at once."
"I'm afraid you're mistaken,"
says Malcolm Gledhill mildly.
"We are not a publicly owned gallery, and you don't own us. Believe me, I would like to clear this matter up as much as you would, but I'm bound by our confidentiality agreement. I'm afraid my hands are tied."
"What if I come back with police and lawyers?" I plant my hands on my hips. "What if I report the painting as stolen goods and force you to reveal the name?" Malcolm Gledhill raises his tufty eyebrows high.
"Obviously, if there was a police inquiry, we would comply fully."
"Well, fine. There will be. I have friends in the police, you know," I add darkly. "D.I. James. He'll be very interested to hear about all this. That painting belonged to Sadie, and now it belongs to my dad and his brother, and we're not just going to sit around and do nothing. I feel all fired up. I'm going to get to the bottom of this. Paintings just don't turn up out of the blue."
I can understand your concerns.
Malcolm Gledhill hesitates.
Believe me, the gallery takes the issue of rightful ownership extremely seriously.
He won't meet my eye. His gaze keeps flicking to the paper in his hand. The name's on there. I know it. I could hurl myself across the desk, wrestle him to the ground, and... No. Well, thank you for your time, I say formally. I'll be in touch again.
Of course.
Malcolm Gledhill is closing up the file again.
Before you go, if I might just call in my colleague, Jeremy Musto. I'm sure he'd be very interested to meet you and to see the photograph of your great-aunt.
A few moments later, a skinny man with fraying cuffs and a prominent Adam's apple is in the room, poring over the photograph of Sadie and saying,
"Remarkable,"
over and over under his breath.
"It's been extremely hard to discover anything about this painting,"
Jeremy Musto says, looking up at last.
"There are so few contemporary records or photographs, and by the time researchers returned to the village, it was generations later and no one could remember anything. And, of course, it had been assumed that the sitter was indeed named Mabel."
He wrinkles his brow.
"I think one thesis was published in the early 1990s, suggesting that a servant of the Nettleton house was Mallory Sitter, and that his parents disapproved of their liaison for class reasons, which led him being sent to France."
I want to laugh. Someone basically made up a completely wrong story and called it research. "There was a Mabel," I explain patiently, "but she wasn't the sitter. Stephen called Sadie Mabel to wind her up. They were lovers," I add. "That's why he was sent to France."
"Indeed."
Jeremy Musto looks up and focuses on me with renewed interest.
"So, would your great-aunt also be the Mabel in the letters?" "The letters!"
exclaims Malcolm Gledhill.
"Of course! I'd forgotten about those. It's such a long time since I've looked at them."
"Letters?" I look from face to face. "What letters?"
"We have in our archive a bundle of old letters written by Mallory,"
explains Jeremy Musto.
"One of the very few sets of documents salvaged after his death. It's not clear if all of them were sent, but one has clearly been posted and returned. Unfortunately, the address was scribbled out in blue-black ink, and despite the very best modern technology, we've been unable to..."
"I'm sorry to interrupt," I cut him off, trying to hide my agitation. "But could I see them?"